I will discuss how to use the information we get from the solution of the flow equation we have in the previous point to get a modified scenario for this singularity. And then I would like to address or try to address the very fundamental question, which is whether we can extend the space-time across the Cauchy horizon. I mean, that's really, I think, it's a essential question. If we will ever have a true theory of gravity, that's, I think, is the question we have to address. And then I'll be presenting my conclusions. So first of all, motivation. Let me put that in with the words of John Archibald Wheeler. So he was probably the first one who has realized that the gravitational collapse, which is what we expect will be the fate of a star, or let's say 10 solar masses, which undergoes gravitational collapse. I mean, the fate of this star is up to, I mean, to the development of the singularity, largely unknown, because not only because we don't have a real theory of gravity, but because we probably have too much of information. And in fact, I would like to stress one very important basic fact. The singularity we expect, which is developed in the gravitational collapse, is teleologically speaking, completely different from what you expect in cosmology. Because in cosmology, we don't know the initial condition. But if we talk about a star or the fate of a star, we know exactly what is the initial condition. So in a sense, we have too much of an information, and we cannot play dirty games. So we know exactly what we expect. And what I'm talking about is that thanks to the uniqueness theorems of general relativity, we know that at very late advanced times, the final state of a star that undergoes a gravitational collapse must be described by the Kerr-Newman solution, which is a solution which is extremely simple. It's the most simpler object we know in nature. It is described by only three parameters. And therefore, at late times, we can say that the external geometry is described by the stationary Kerr-Newman solution. There is no doubt on that. So we know what is the evolution, the external evolution at very late times. On the other hand, we have these extreme, that's probably the most important problem in classical general relativity, the cosmic censorship principle. And we know that according to this censorship, the singularity in a physical black hole ought to be space-like. That's really the prediction we should have, we should expect if we were able to prove the cosmic censorship scenario. And must be described by this Belinsky, Lifshitz, Kalashnikov type of singularity. So it's a very chaotic singularity. The approach of the singularity must be of the chaotic type. And we can, in principle, expect that that should be the case. But the point is that the solution, the exact solution we know from textbooks in general relativity, like the Kerr-Newman solution, that is what we expect we have at very late times, as a time-like singularity, at r equals 0. So that's the key of the problem. So what is happening here? How is it, I mean, how is it possible that what we suppose is the most generic solution we have, it is really conflicting what we think is the cosmic censorship conclusion. I mean, to be more specific, I mean, that is what everybody probably knows. That's the Penrose diagram of a static Schwarzschild black hole. I mean, that's the singularity I'm talking about. That's just an eternal black hole. So there is no star here, no gravitational collapse. And that is for an electrically charged black hole, but it's, I mean, that is the same you will get for a Kerr black hole. And now you can see here that the singularity is time-like, and that is a disaster. And that's the reason why this is called Cauchy horizon. Because here, what is happening, we are losing the unicity, unique evolution of the initial data. If we put the initial data along some space-like hypersurface here, across this line, the evolution will not be unique. Okay? And that is something that, in principle, one should not be surprised, because we have many physical systems where this happens. For instance, in fluid dynamics. Every time we have a shock wave, then we lose the unique evolution across the singularity. But then we say, okay, but that is an artifact, because if we were able to resolve the singularity and look at the microphysics, in principle, we should be able to go across the singularity and still have a unique evolution for the space-time. Okay, then one can say, okay, so let's perturb this solution. So let's try to understand what is happening. So that is something which was first noted by Roger Penrose. So what is happening here? Here, that is the Cauchy horizon. Okay, that is the event horizon. That is where we are. That is this room here, sucked down here. Okay, and now we have to stress that this point here is a singular point in the conformal diagram. This point does not exist in the conformal diagram, because we are compactifying an infinite time in a finite domain. So what is happening? Suppose I am an observer who is crossing the event horizon, and I would like to cross the Cauchy horizon. I cross the Cauchy horizon in a finite amount of my proper time. So if I have my watch, I can see how many seconds I need to wait where I go from the event horizon to the Cauchy horizon. But here, all these light-like photons are coming from the whole future history, because that is the whole future history of the universe. You see what is happening? So in a finite amount, that was the argument by Penrose, in a finite amount of my proper time, I'll be causally connected with all the future history of the universe. So, and then, he was the first one to point out that this must be a problem. So if you want to do perturbation theory in this kind of situation, something must happen. And that is a very childish exercise you can do. I mean, that's just the geodesic equation for an observer who likes to travel across the Cauchy horizon using, for instance, I mean, the Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. And that is dot means derivation with respect to the proper time, and V is the advanced Eddington coordinate, so it's the advanced time. And what is happening here is that you can very easily realize that this function near the Cauchy horizon is the Laplace function near the inner Cauchy horizon is very small. So what will happen is at the end the calculation that v dot will be given, that the relation between the proper time and the coordinate time is given by this expression, and therefore the energy density, which is measured by our observer, will be given by this expression and will be eventually be divergent unless this function is something strange. As v, little v goes to infinity, little v goes to infinity is the location of the Cauchy horizon. And that is a luminosity function, which we imagine, just from the initial data, we know is finite. And then there is something which I would like to point out. There was something which came to my mind yesterday after listening to the talk about dynamical triangulation and foliation. I mean, when we talk about the interior evolution, we have to be careful about the slicing. But the initial data, you see, the initial data is known because of the Noether theorem. And near the event horizon, we have the perturbed Kerr space-time with a dying tail of gravitational waves. That's our initial data, which comes from the collapse of the star. We know how these gravitational waves have to die in terms of the advanced time. Okay? And they die as a power law of the advanced time, where p is a multiple of order L of these gravitational wave tails crossing the event horizon. And then, and that is what I was saying that at the beginning, in principle, we have a well-posed problem. So we have the field equation, we give our initial condition, and we evolve the field equation from the exterior to the interior. That there is no way, there is nothing strange about that. We know exactly the initial condition, which is the opposite of what we have in cosmology. But this problem is very difficult because it's a complete, very, very nonlinear, as I will show. And that is the point I wanted to make. That's probably the most important slides on my talk. And it's not so childish as one would think, because it shows exactly what is happening. You see, this point here is a point in the future, in the present. Next year, that point, which is slightly far, is a point in the future. So that is what is happening. So the R coordinate is now time-like. The space coordinate, the time coordinate is space-like, and the R coordinate is time-like. So, I mean, a point distant from me is a point in the future. Okay, that is the point I would like to make. So it's, I mean, even if at the level of semi-classical, not even quantum gravity, you know, how can we describe a quantum field theory in such a situation? I have no idea to now how to do that. But that is the situation that once you keep this in mind, that the R coordinate is time-like and the time coordinate is space-like, then you have to go to the physics of the problem. And that is what we have in a realistic black hole. Okay, that's another Penrose diagram. And there you have a star which is collapsing. That's the star which is collapsing. It's crossing the event horizon. And that is the potential barrier that you expect to have inside. Okay? Here you have another potential barrier. Okay? And you have your gravitational waves, which are from this potential barrier, which I haven't shown, but scattered inside. And here you have one flow of gravitational waves which goes this way, and the other flow which goes through the Cauchy horizon. But just a scattering, just think of a scattering problem, and that is a potential barrier. But what is scattered is gravitational waves, okay? We know they go along light-like geodesics, so in principle, we can solve this problem, okay? But remember, this is the crucial point. This point, I mean, these extend indefinitely in this direction. So his past evolution is infinite. And now, what we do. We take, we would like to, what people have done, have used this initial condition, and try to evolve the system. So now, suppose I get a computer, I try to, I know what is the initial condition, and I try to evolve the field equation, giving the, let's say, we'll have to go back. So I give my initial condition here, and I see what happens. And many people have tried to understand what should be the outcome from the numerical point of view and from the theoretical point of view. And I would like to, I must put some basic reference to this point at some point. This is the most, one of the most important work in this art, which was a very famous result by Poisson in Israel. And then there is a, there has been, after this paper, lots of other results, try to understand what is the outcome of that. I mean, there is something which I did in 1995, it's a very controversial paper, though it was published, where I suggested also the angular momentum must have some problem inside. And there is also a long list of papers by the Haifa group on that. But then the nice news, the very nice news to me is that very recently there was, there is also another paper in 2009, a renewed interest in this problem. So what happened at the Cauchy horizon there? What do we understand exactly, 2009? So, and what was the result of this paper? That is the first seminal paper. And in this, in their model, this is the Poisson-Israel model, which I'll try to discuss exactly what we expect in this model. We have to simplify the model to understand what is happening. So forget about integration of real field equations along across the Cauchy horizon. So for the moment, let's imagine we model our gravitational waves with an inflow and outflow of null, just a null light-like flow, okay? That is what we, we would like to do. And consider pure spherical symmetry, not care, where everything will be much more complicated. Therefore, my stress energy tensor is given by this expression. That is the luminosity of the ingoing light-like flow. That is the luminosity of the outgoing light-like flow. And I know that that is the initial data. So that is what must be set as initial data in my luminosity function. And you can see, I mean, that is the location of the Cauchy horizon is a capital V equals zero. Capital V is the Kruskalized advanced time, which I'm sure everybody knows, but just to remind you, capital V is minus e to the plus 2k in little v, the k in is the surface gravity of the inner horizon. That's the relation. So the Cauchy horizon is at v, which goes to zero from the left. That's the location of the Cauchy horizon. And then it's possible to define a mass function. And I mean, this mass function is actually the Hawking quasi-local area, which is an integral of the, you must consider the congruence of the ingoing and outgoing light shell and take the expansion and take the two-dimensional and take the, I mean, the two-dimensional integral of this expansion. So the expansion of the ingoing light, no, so you have a, if that is umu is a null vector, you can consider umu comma mu as theta. That is the expansion of the ingoing congruence. I mean, that's, and then you have, this is for the ingoing part, and then you have the expansion for the outgoing part, and you must take the integral over the two-dimensional volume, which is actually the degenerate metric of this congruence. That is a very smart definition Stephen Hawking has given for a mass in a a situation where we have no Hilling vector. We will not know how to define a mass otherwise. And the result was that, And the result of their analysis was that the mass function, this mass function, is singular as v goes to zero. That is a, so it's a very mild singularity, but then this invariant of the curvature is infinite. I would like to stress the basic point of the discussion. Once again. So we are here, okay? That is the event horizon, that is the Cauchy horizon. We are here is the place, the inner horizon, where we have the singularity. The radius of this, of the inner horizon, can be a macroscopic distance. So our Cauchy horizon can be 10 meters for an astrophysical black hole. So this type of singularity is not something you imagine should appear at very small distances. That's why I think it's a very challenging singularity, and any theory of gravity should try to address this type of issue, because the distance from me and the Cauchy horizon can be 10 meters, and yet the curvature can be Planckian. And so that is, if you see in the literature, there are nice solutions, loop quantum gravity black holes, very fine, but all the problems are basically trying to address the static black hole singularity. But now we are very far from the Planck scale, but the curvature is Planckian. And then what options do we have? Option number one, one can say space-time just stops here. Let's try to put what options we have. The second option is that quantum gravity effects should cure the singularity, even though we are in a distance which is not Planckian. Okay. Third possibility is more subtle. Maybe nature is more subtle. We can still extend the space-time almost classically as we do in fluid dynamics. So it's a very intriguing possibility. If that is true, then the question is whether the extension will be unique or not. So it's another type of question, but at the end we would like to have a unique extension. So about quantum effects, the only work I know was the first attempt by Anderson, Israel, Brady, and Morphy in 1993, where they tried to do a semi-classical analysis. And another work I did with Martin, I think it was 1996. It was the first work we had done together. There have been some semi-classical dilaton gravity model. And now you have this work by Hamilton and Novikov, where they still try to do some semi-classical analysis. Now, the question is whether the asymptotic safety scenario can say something about this type of singularity. And the question, and the real point is that how do we encode the running of G? So now suppose that the information we get from asymptotic safety is that the G, the dimensionful coupling constant, must go to zero at very high energy. So in principle, we should be able to say something about that. And so and now, I am not too provocative, but when we talk about randomization group improvement of dynamical equations, I think we are doing very similar to what was done more than 100 years ago. So I like to put that in this way: this Le Chatelier-Brown principle. No, every physical system in stable equilibrium, under the influence of an external force, a change in environmental property, for instance, which tends to alter an intensive characteristic B of the system, like pressure, whatever, everywhere, or just in some part, what happens? Can only experience interior changes, the secondary effect, in some other parameter of state of the system, which are usually extensive. So how do the system fits fight back to what is happening? No? What we are saying in the asymptotic safety scenario is that we have an instability of the vacuum. We would like to understand how this instability fights back. It's fed back to our equation. But what we are doing is just try to apply this principle, I think. And therefore, to do that, we need the renormalization group trajectory near the non-Gaussian fixed point. And we must insert this trajectory into the field equations. That's not the solution, that the best way of addressing the problem. That's the only way I know up to now. Try to take the information from the renormalization group and use this information into the Einstein equations. And let's suppose this trajectory, because it's close to the asymptote to the ultraviolet fixed point, it's only valid near the Cauchy horizon, so it cannot be used for everyday life. And then you compute a new mass function and see the feedback of this mass function in your equations. And so I'll try to do that using this what is called proper time flow equation for gravity. And now let me come back to the second part of my talk. This is an equation which, as you see, it looks like a one loop proper time expression, which has been regularized through this threshold function, which is actually a function which is a cutoff in the proper time. So it's not a real cutoff in the propagator. It doesn't have the same meaning. So one must be very careful. But it's regularized, and one can show that it sums a certain number of graphs. I want to say this equation is not an exact equation. It's not an exact equation at the ideal level, so at the level of the functional equation. Okay, that's not. There is no way. I don't believe to any proof that this is an exact equation at the level of functional renormalization group equation. On the other hand, it works very nice if I do a truncation, because I don't think that we can control when we do a local potential approximation how bad or how far we are, how nice or close we are from the exact flow. And to give you a flavor of what has been achieved with this type of equation for the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, I would like to show this. This is not very new result, but still the numbers are quite nice. What I got with Dario Zappalà concerning the anomalous dimension at the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. And then that's M is the regulator. That's how we could get, how far we could get with our computation. And I would like to stress that this is very close to this very famous number from Guida and Giusten, 1998, where they use semi-loop perturbation theory in D equal 3. So I haven't put any the number for the ERG for that, because at the number of at the time of this paper, I think that the number was quite different. I'm sure they have done some other work on that, but I could not find a newer reference. Probably there is some work by Bervier on that, but he used the Polchinski equation and it goes to the fourth order. But that I'm not sure about that, so I don't want to do any. I'm not doing a comparison with other flow equations, so don't take it in that way. So those are the beta function that you get from this, if you apply this equation for gravity. And you see that they are quite simple. That is the anomalous dimension. That is the beta function. And the good news from my point of view was that I could, those are the critical exponents. So let me show that in this case. That is the critical exponent. That is the fixed point, that is m. And it's very beautiful to me to notice that the location of the fixed point is really dependent on the cutoff, because that's not a universal quantity. I don't understand why people really confront the location of fixed point. That's not a universal quantity. So there is no point in talking, I think, about the location of the fixed point. But this product, it's nicely universal. And the critical exponent, that's the real part, the imaginary part, they really look, they are not dependent on the cutoff. And in fact, if I plot that in this, in the plot where I use this my cutoff truncation, then I can clearly see that immediately I get some convergence for the critical exponent and this universal quantity. Of course, it would be nice to go to some higher truncation, but at the moment, that is what we have. And then you can integrate this explicitly. So that's an exact solution in the case where you have no cosmological constant. So that is the solution, and that is the crucial point of this discussion. I want now to feedback this. That is the running with k. That's the running with k of the gravitational constant. I want to dynamically couple this information in the Einstein equation. And therefore, I have to link my cutoff to the dynamics of the spacetime. And the most convincing way of doing that is to use the Coulombian, in quotes and quotes, component of the Weyl curvature. Because that is the only one we have for spherical symmetry. We are in spherical symmetry. It only fills the gravitational path, because that's Weyl tensor, and that it has a very extremely nice physical meaning, because it measures the tidal force in some point of the space time. So it's a way of telling it. If I were to ask myself how long it will take for me to be destroyed by singularity of the black hole, I just have to take the square root of this and take the inverse, and that is the time scale which I need to get the singularity. And I can look that if I integrate along a geodesic up to k equals 0, I will get exactly the same answer if I use this. So it has very nice property. At least that is the best I could find in this kind of situation. And now I have to change the Einstein equation to include this information. And how to do that? The best way to do that is to use a double null formalism. So I split the Einstein equation in a lifelike part and in a time-like part. And these quantities, coordinates, will be lifelike at the end. And I can completely decompose the Einstein equation in the lifelike part and in the spacetime. So I can define these two functions, this f, this m, in this way. Should be capital. That's what you will get if you use the Hawking quasi-local mass to define the mass. And then I have this dimensional reduced Einstein equation, which I can now use. So it will be really stupid to plug the equation in a computer. I mean, let's say not stupid, but not very clever, to plug the equation in the computer as they are, without understanding exactly what degrees of freedom are responsible for the divergence. Okay, so one has to think a bit, and that's I think is the best, what I was able to find is the less stupid way of doing that. And that is very general. And this k is our k, which is now coupled with our beta function through the equation. And of course, you must be sure to solve the constraint equation, which I have not written, because we also have to to preserve the homomorphic invariant. So things are not so simple, but I will not bother you with technical details. But the nice news is that I can write a wave equation for the mass function. That's the bottom line of my discussion up to this point. That's the wave equation for the mass function, which is very general. And this is the D'Alembertian operator in the two-dimensional space span by my double null coordinates. And if I use as a double null coordinate just a Kruskalized coordinate, it's very easy to show that this near the Cauchy horizon, actually this is partial derivative with respect to the outgoing and ingoing Kruskal coordinate. So you can actually solve, you can actually put this in a computer and solve. That only depends on the mass now. There is no whatever indication or cutoff, anything. You can just solve that in a computer. And that is the answer, which is very surprising to me. The singularity is still there, as you see. There is this expression. If V goes to zero, it's still singular. It's still singular. So the mass function is still singular. And at the beginning, I was very depressed when I saw that. But then I realized there is something, there is also very good news. So that there is the classical behavior, the Poisson-Ori model. Okay? But with the new things, this quantity is now integrable along V. So what I'm saying is that the force, the energy, no? It's just the force over the S. This is fine if I want to cross the Cauchy horizon. So in principle, I can, even the force is infinite, I can still try to traverse this. There was a long discussion in the literature because this was not integrable. But only the two eyes you had to integrate. So the deformation and tidal force were finite, but not the tidal force. So now what we have, the energy integrated along the Cauchy horizon is finite. And that brings me to the crucial question of the Cauchy horizon singularity. The tidal acceleration diverges at the Cauchy horizon. But the tidal acceleration, the tidal force integrated along the infalling geodesic, does not diverge at the Cauchy horizon. It's actually finite. So in principle, I can say, okay, you guys, you can build a spacecraft which is able to pass the Cauchy horizon because the integrated energy will be finite. And that is really in sharp contrast with the original model, which only the physical distortion was finite at the Cauchy horizon. And then the question is, do we predict a C1 continuation of the classical spacetime along the Cauchy horizon? And to do that, we must first try to understand the structure of the metric along the Cauchy horizon, because what I've been discussing was only the singularity. So, but what is the metric? Is the metric regular? So can we at least think of having a C0 continuation along the singularity? And that is a bit more complicated. So first of all, maybe I have to go back to this part. So what I'm trying to now to discuss is the following. So that is, let's say, Eddington Finkelstein coordinate of my spacetime. Now the foliation will be this because time goes this way, okay? And that is the early part of the event horizon. That is early part of the Cauchy horizon. That is the inner potential barrier, and that is the outflow and the inflow which cross the generators of the Cauchy horizon. What will happen eventually? Eventually, will happen that the generators will cross will eventually die at r equals 0. And here you have a Planckian type of singularity. So eventually, in this part, you will have to have, you must have a real singularity, an r equals 0 singularity. No? But that happens much after. The early part here is singular. And so I try to say, OK, let's put a minimally coupled scalar field in this background and see what happens. Just test it. OK? And then you can play around with the equations. Now the equations are this. You must be careful. I mean, that is the terms, the metric, which is the only scalar that I have in the metric now. So the metric is written in this way. So that's the sigma that you see there. And then you can define functions A of capital U and B of capital V by setting the derivatives A dot and B dot equal to the, I mean, that's the way I construct the solution, at the values underside the inner potential barrier. So that's the solution is very localized. So I'm just trying to set my initial data in these slides here, where I know what is the effect of the tail of the gravitational waves. And then, well, if you look at the equations, what is happening is that you can find that this is an asymptotic solution for the metric just near the Cauchy horizon. But so the asymptotic solution, you see, that's the scalar field. That is the radius. That is the sparse. That is the Reissner-Nostrom value. Look at this expression. That's the essential point here and here. At the end, this function A has this property. So that is A and that is B. They go to 0. At they are regular function at the Cauchy horizon, but the derivatives, no. So what I'm saying is that the metric is probably C0, but it's not C1. And so the bottom line is that we probably have a regular metric, a singular spacetime with the regular metric. We might think to be so crazy to try to cross it because the energy is finite, but it's, I will not believe one can have a unique continuation of the spacetime across the Cauchy horizon. So now I come to my conclusions. And the conclusions are the following. The mass inflation singularity seems to survive also in this, let's say, very simplified model of asymptotic safety, where I try to include the feedback of the running of G in this system, okay, in the Eisen-Hilbert truncation. That is an important point I would like to stress. The strength of the singularity is even weaker than in the original mass inflation model. So now we have that the tidal forces are integrable across the Cauchy horizon. And the conjecture which was made a few years ago by Amos Ori that at least a continuous extension is possible, I think is reinforced by my work. But we probably have to pay the unicity. But the other question is, what happens if we go beyond the Eisen-Hilbert truncation? The point is that if we believe that now the critical manifold is three-dimensional, in principle, we should be able to discuss that, including the other terms which should be there, the critical manifold, and try to address this problem maybe without even doing a renormalization group improvement, just trying to understand if there are regular black holes with regular Cauchy horizon, regular cross flow models in higher derivative gravity. That's a very interesting thing to do, but it's a lot of work. Thank you very much for your attention.
Yes.
So the standard picture, when I cross the horizon, I get burned by all the photons of the future history of the universe.
Yes, so you'll get everything flash.
And now with the finite energy, do I still see all the photons, but they are redshifted, or?
No. They are still there, in the first case, the space-time was not singular. So the Riemann tensor was singular only in some the parallel propagated frame, so you can still argue that it's not a real singularity. But when I have the cross flow model, when I consider this flow coming in and being backscattered here, then the Weyl tensor is singular. But so I still have that, but one can say, okay, in principle, that's just a problem of your reference frame.
In what context was that conjecture formulated? Was it in quantum gravity or classical gravity?
There was a long discussion in the literature about that. It was not a quantum gravity context. It was a sort of a fluid dynamics analogy. But I think it's very misleading, because when we have a shock wave, a shock in a fluid, the density, the field itself, the field is discontinuous. The pressure, they have a jump. Now the field is continuous. So what Amos was saying is that we are in a vector equation. We have something which is continuous. Maybe we can even have a C1 extension, which you don't have in fluid mechanics. So, but that is still a very tough problem. It's a very nonlinear calculation we are trying to do. But that's what we expect in real black holes. That's not just static stationary solutions.
What happens with your construction if you take the charge of the black hole to zero?
No, I don't. I have only a space-time singularity. So, but your question is the following: we have that. Yes. I'm not sure if I am understanding, but the charge here is only to mimic the curve space time. It's only to have a toy model which is causally similar to what you will get in curve. So, but what you expect is that if that is the event horizon, if that is the Cauchy horizon, then of course this part is not there anymore. And so for a normal spatial black hole, you will have just a r equals zero singularity. And that is fine, because, I mean, it's fine as at least you don't have a problem of unicity, that you know that if you are here, you will leave singularity. And then you can come to me and say, oh, I have a new theory of gravity, and I know how to solve this problem.
I'm just curious if when you take your construction and formally take the charge or the angular momentum to zero, do you just reproduce the conventional Schwarzschild with the space-like
yes,
singularity?
Yes, definitely.
Other questions? Well, if not, let's thank the speaker again.
Now, John Carrasco.